Support for The Best of Our Knowledge comes from the College of St. Rose in Albany, offering master's and certificate programs for working adults looking to advance or change their careers. Easily accessible to downtown and state offices, the College of St. Rose has served the Capital District since 1920. strose.edu/grad programs to apply.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Hope Jaron was one of those rare children who had a definite answer when someone asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up. She wanted to build her own lab and work in it every day, just like her father.
Some of my very first memories are being in the lab, what it smelled like, what it felt like, what the machine sounded like.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to Dr. Jaron about her book called Lab Girl, which talks about her science, her labs, and her life. We'll also tour a new manufacturing institute in New York and spend an academic minute hitting the slopes. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If anyone has earned the title Lab Girl, it's Dr. Hope Jaron. She spent many days while growing up playing in her father's lab at a community college in a small Minnesota town. She's gone on to build several labs of her own, and as a geobiologist, studies trees and flowers and seeds and soil. Hope Jaron is now a professor of geobiology at the University of Oslo in Norway. You can read the story of her personal and professional life, not to mention the story of quite a few plants, in the book Lab Girl, which has just been released in paperback. I spoke to Dr. Jaron by cell phone recently and quite cleverly asked how long the seed for this book has been germinating.
Well, it's an interesting story. It started out as a textbook. And then once I got into writing it a little bit, I realized this is not a textbook. This is a story. It's a story about not just what we discovered, but how we discovered it and the people that were important along the way and what we did with our lives while we were also being scientists. And once I put that all together, it wasn't a textbook anymore. It was about plants, and it was about me, and it was about the people I cared about. It was a very different kind of book. And when we brought it out, there were a fair number of people who read it and said, hey, I'm not sure what kind of book that is either, but there's something good there.
You call the work you do curiosity-driven research. What does that mean?
Yes. So that means that I do experiments and I work on problems in the lab, but there's no obvious, straightforward, right-away kind of application to it. I don't test a drug that somebody might prescribe for somebody who's sick. I don't try to find a stronger material to build a bridge. There's no obvious way in which this is going to benefit someone. It's about knowing about how the world works. And, of course, our belief is that down the road, it spirals into, it bleeds into all these other things that do result in all the great inventions that affect our daily lives. But I'm at the headwaters of that particular process, the very start of it. And it's a different kind of research because it relies very heavily on my own curiosity and my own drive to figure things out.
Well, apparently that curiosity started when you were growing up because you literally did grow up in a lab, didn't you?
Right. So the book is called Lab Girl, and that's no mistake. I was a very little girl in a lab. Some of my very first memories are being in the lab, what it smelled like, what it felt like, what the machine sounded like, what the glassware sparkled, etc. My father taught community college. He taught at the same community college for 42 consecutive years, and he taught everything from chemistry to physics to earth science, and physics was his true love. But he would go there in the evenings and set up for the next day, and me and my brothers would go with him, and we would take care of the equipment and fix anything that needed fixed and set stuff up and make sure it worked. And I just loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved being there, and my father loved it. It was his favorite place. And so by the time I was old enough to say what I wanted to be when I grew up, I didn't really know. I just knew that I wanted to have a lab because that's what you had when you grew up. And it was going to be a big lab and it had a bunch of stuff in it. And we were going to have all kinds of fun doing different things. And that's the one thing I've always known for sure is that I belong in a lab.
I love your description of your father saying that he was not a scientist in town. He was the scientist in town.
Right. So it was a small town in rural Minnesota, and he taught all the sciences, you know, at the community college. And he taught people that we knew, you know, your teachers were the same people that had been his students, et cetera. And so his identity in the town was really, you know, he was the guy that knew physics and was ultra patient and loved to teach it to people. And I watched that and I said, yeah, that's what I want to be. That's the thing to be.
When you decided on your field of studying plants and things that grow, you're going out into the great outdoors, yet you still came back and loved working in that lab, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I like to study plants because it was kind of the hardest problem I could possibly think of. You know, most of physics, things act like they're supposed to, you know, balls roll and pendulums swing and all that kind of stuff. But you get into growing a plant and most of the time, it's not going to do what you want it to do. And then you got to figure out why. And it's a whole different world once you introduce living organisms. And plants are so very different from us. You know, we can't even relate to them like we can to animals in some ways, that it was just the hardest problem I could come up with that would require the most curiosity and imagination and drive to really keep things going. And it's kept me going for quite a few years now.
You write about people not really seeing the plant life and the trees around them. And I've read your descriptions of trees and seeds and big muddy holes, and I don't think I could see them the way you do.
Well, I do this for a living, so I do it day in and day out, and that's one of the benefits, is that I can share things that I've noticed from spending all that time, you know, with people who, you don't spend your time that way. You work in a different field, but kind of the magic of what's come to me is that there's a few things you can point out about how trees work or what's outside your window or whatever that, and you see the spark in somebody's eyes, and they think, well, I never thought about it that way. And maybe when they walk home, they'll look at the world a little bit differently. It's a pretty lofty goal to try to change the way somebody looks at the world. But if you look at plants and you realize they're all around us, and then you really start to think about how they're alive. They're alive, just like you are. They're trying to do things, and they're trying to stay alive, et cetera. They're different than you, but there's something amazing about when it really clicks in that we're living in a world that's also living. I love to teach that. And this book is a way of sharing that with a bigger classroom in some ways. That's what it's all about.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Hope Jaron continues with a look at how climate change may affect her work. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Hope Jaron, and we're talking about her book called Lab Girl. Dr. Jaron is a geobiologist studying plants and seeds and soil, so I asked if her field will start getting a lot more attention now that climate change is becoming a more obvious and pressing problem. And again, our conversation took place over a cell phone.
I think we're at a real crossroads in America with respect to the environment. It's getting harder and harder to study the earth, to study the way plants function and the way animals function and the outdoors. You know, is the outdoors changing? And exactly how is it changing? I mean, that requires support. We have to have a lab to do it in, and we have to have jobs and three meals a day in an ideal world. And it's really getting harder and harder to put those pieces together. And I don't know if the average person knows that. You know, people think science is a safe career. It's a solid thing. You know, there's a paycheck there, but it really hasn't been a safe thing for us. And I see that road getting harder and harder every year.
I did read in there that you said if you talk to a scientist about their biggest worry, inevitably it's going to come down to the word money, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So if I decide to do an experiment, I say, well, I'd really like to test whether tomatoes get a lot bigger if we shield them from greenhouse gas, or if it doesn't make any difference. Let's say I'd like to test that. And it sounds like a worthwhile thing to do, and I'm skilled. I know how to do it, and I've got the machinery. I have to put in a request in order to get the resources to devote my labor to that for a couple years to answer that question. And most of what I do in my job is hustle, try to get that support to do these ideas, to use the scientific expertise that I was trained to have, to get an opportunity to teach students who want to learn how to do these things, who want to make these tests and find out the answers. So much of what we do is, you know, hanging on by a thread, trying to get the okay, trying to get the nickels and dimes to buy the chemicals, to buy the Dixie cups to grow the plants in them, etc. It's such a big part of the job.
Is there a place for your work or science in general outside of a college or university setting?
My science has always been very curiosity driven, right? So there's no obvious place in a company that this could turn into a product that might turn a profit. And that's how companies work. And so it really is our universities that support the basic questions of curiosity, just figuring stuff out and training students how to figure stuff out. You know, the students that go and work in companies and solve problems for people. People like me trained them, how do you ask a question and how do you set things up to figure it out? So a lot of that work, it really belongs in the university because it's not just something we need to do, it's something we need to teach. And so universities, they play a really special role in research. And I also wanted readers to see what a special thing that is and a special sort of unique lifestyle and unique stresses and unique challenges and unique relationships that come out of living that life.
How many labs have you built? How many empty rooms have you walked into and turned into a lab?
I'm on my fourth one. So, and you always start with the electrical. And you better get the electrical right because you're going to be kicking yourself for years later if you put the electrical in the wrong place. Which is, I mean, I talk a lot about curiosity and things like that. But then again, you know, a lot of the stuff we do every day just comes down to plain old work. And we do our best. And we also, you know, we use our hands and we have some skills. But, you know, putting together a lab from scratch, oh, that's the best part. You know, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. You know, if I have a day to myself and I can do anything I want, I'll automatically go into the lab. That's the place where I'm just truly happiest.
Well, this is not just a story about your work. It's a story about your life. And you talk about your upbringing in a family that did not really communicate very well, kept to themselves. How was it with that upbringing to open up so much about so many personal issues and stories in this book?
I think that there's a reason behind the parts of yourself that you show. It wasn't an exercise in just showing myself for the sake of showing myself. I was looking at, for many years, I thought, you know, does the world need another book? You go into a bookstore and there's books up past your eyebrows, you know, and everybody's got more books than they can read. But there were a couple things that were very true in my life that I'd never seen in a book before. And one of them was, you know, what's it really like to be a scientist? We give our kids all kinds of messages about, you know, science is good and, oh, let's go to Mars and girls need to be scientists. Let's get girls involved. Blah, blah, blah. But we don't have any true recollections of what is it really like, honestly, honestly, day to day. What is the life really like? And when I set out to fill that gap, in order to do it right and to do it honestly, I had to talk about myself. And so in the end, I did my best. And I hope I put out a book that isn't just like everything else on the shelves. I know it's not.
You succeeded there, that is for sure. I just have to ask, how's Bill? And could you have made these moves and that built those labs without him?
No. Bill fine. He's doing very, very well. No, we're a team, you know, and we accomplish more together than we could solo, and we're a good deal. You know, anybody that hires us is getting quite a lot out of us. It's a good deal. It wouldn't make sense for us to do this job without each other. And so that's the way it is. And you know, that's, being able to do a job you love is one thing, but being able to do it with your best friend, I can't think of anything better. I really can't. And that's as much a reason as anything to write a book about it.
Again, the name of Dr. Hope Jaron's book is Lab Girl. It's just been released in paperback by Vintage Books. In September 2014, Clinton Community College received a $12.7 million grant through the SUNY 2020 Challenge Program to create and build the Institute for Advanced Manufacturing. It broke ground on the facility in May 2016. Late last month, the college updated officials on the status of construction and provided tours of the partially completed facility. The best of our knowledge is Pat Bradley was there.
The 30,000-square-foot facility will house technology programs to train students in a variety of manufacturing sectors. Director of Advanced Manufacturing and Technology, Christopher Renedette, is taking a group of officials through the site.
Where we are standing right now, we like to call this the High Bay Area. We have 30-foot clear span ceiling in this area. The whole theme of this facility is to be as much like walking into a manufacturing facility as possible, and to look, feel, and to be flexible. Just building a building for today is not good enough. Building a building for 50 and 100 years from now was the goal from the beginning.
Renedette leads the group to the Low Bay area, where a flexible manufacturing lab is planned.
So in here, there's two main labs. There's a mechatronics or mechanical technology lab. So the term mechatronics, that's mechanical, electrical, automation controls, and computer systems kind of all into one. Students there learn all the hands-on skills from hydraulics to pneumatics to electrical components, programmable logic controllers, PLCs, robots and automation, how to troubleshoot all of those systems. That's the type of systems that are in industry today. It better prepares them for the workforce they're going into. The other area or key lab in here is the 3D printing lab.
The group then heads upstairs to see future computer labs, a distance learning conference room, and manufacturing labs. Back on the floor, Empire State Development Vice President for Industry Development Mike Morse says this is what the state hopes for when it makes investments in communities. He believes this facility will be a model for manufacturing training across the state.
I don't know of any other location in the state that has a facility like this, that will have the capabilities that this facility will have and some of the cross-training that will occur here. You're going to have people learning high-level computer advanced manufacturing skills while on the other side of a wall, you may have someone learning how to do advanced welding. And people might think, yeah, welding, computers, that doesn't go together. In the changing economy and then in the future economy, it does. It needs to. So there's great vision here.
Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas quoted Winston Churchill as he spoke to the assembled crowd.
He said, first we shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us. And I think it particularly is true in this case. It's going to shape us as a community, as an economic region. It is really going to help us shape the future. Clinton Community College saw and took the advice of the business community to design this building and made this exactly what the business community asked for. Two particularly non-traditional partnerships that you're going to see, I predict, really blossom here. One with Clarkson University and the other with Champlain College up in Longueuil, Quebec, which is one of the primary training platforms for the transportation equipment and aerospace sector in southern Quebec. So there's going to be some really unique things going on here.
Clinton Community College President Ray DePasquale reports that the building is approximately 70% complete. Construction is ahead of schedule and on budget. Completion is expected in May, and technology programs will begin in the fall. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Big-name companies who make ski equipment have no problem getting their products on store shelves and, by extension, out on the slopes. So how do the smaller ski makers compete with those mountainous giants? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do smaller firms compete with their larger counterparts? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Kevin Kasky, professor of operations management at SUNY New Paltz, explores avenues that smaller downhill ski manufacturers use to get their products on the slopes.
As we talk about bringing back manufacturing, and as winter season is underway, the ski industry gives us an opportunity to demonstrate two approaches that allow smaller U.S. firms to compete in an industry dominated by large foreign players: specialization and customization. The worldwide market for downhill skis is dominated by four large firms, three manufacturing in the Alps and one in China. There are also a few slightly smaller firms, but none of these firms produce in the United States. There are, however, over 100 firms based in the USA, and most of these manufacture here as well. To enter an established market, one must offer something different or do something differently. Specialization offers something different, while customization is doing skis differently. These smaller firms specialize more often than they customize and focused on niches that may not interest the larger producers. Their designs can be more radical and materials less traditional. They were early in the trend of very wide skis, while others addressed niche purposes such as backcountry skiing or markets such as the harsher conditions of New England skiing. Customization varies from as simple as allowing the customer to pick from standardized components to full specification of design parameters. To be fair, not all of the firms do succeed, nor are they all trying to, but quitting the day job can come as soon as a few hundred pairs sold. For some, there is more to success than sales. When asked about producing elsewhere, such as China, one owner quickly said to me, "The point is to build skis in the Rockies."
That was Kevin Kasky of SUNY New Paltz. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.